All right, welcome in, everybody. Inside the Gamecocks, the show. Final hour of our live super stream here. And we have a special guest with us today, JC. Jamie's in.
Jamie's holding over.
Not for much longer.
That's right. Jamie's got a topic.
Have we paid that British lady's invoice yet for saying, now back to the show?
And we keep renewing.
We're having trouble with her visa or work visa.
That's right.
Actually, ICE deported her a long time ago.
That's right. She's not here anymore.
She made an illegal shepherd's pie and took it to a bake sale. And
I never knew she was actually here.
She's going to try to get back on the equipment shipment when North Carolina comes back from Ireland this this month.
That's what they're investigating Michael Lombardi for in Chapel Hill.
Is she? Okay.
ICE is all over him. That's right. His butt. Yeah,
we're who's this British lady y'all stashed in the broom closet over here?
Help me! Help me! Help me! Shut up!
That's right.
Quiet, woman.
Quiet.
Quiet, Mary Poppins.
You will go to sleep, or I will put you to sleep.
puts the lotion in the basket.
we literally could do this all day. I first of all, before I get out of here, want to thank our new Wednesday lineup of David Cloninger and Chris Clark in hour one. They were, as always, phenomenal. And we got not lucky at all, but it worked out to have DC, somebody who has known my friend, our friend, everybody's friend, Jim Thoman, for as long as he has. So that was really neat. And really appreciate Monty being kind enough to jump in here. And let's be honest, probably in front of a bunch of people who don't really care about him anymore, and talk about Jim Thoman's influence on his life and the University of South Carolina. So appreciate all that. Rest in peace to my dear friend. I'm going to miss you, Jim Thoman. Storm, the big guy, all that stuff. It's been an awesome day and celebrating him and talking South Carolina football with Chris and Rob and DC as well. Yesterday, we did get the coaches poll. And I was telling Phil earlier, JC, I'm not going to rehash the whole thing because obviously there's a lot of people who just heard this and don't want to hear it again. But I was pretty shocked when I was doing my schedule analysis column. And the reason that I waited to do that is because I like to have more information to work off of. Like a lot of the stuff that comes out in April, May, June, you know, July, it's hard for me to always buy into those things. It's still hard for me to buy into it, but it's hard to buy into it when – I'm not so sure what people are going off of. Well, by this time, you know, you've got the guys who do the homework like Brett and Phil, and obviously the coaches put their votes in. How much do you put in that? I don't know. But I do find it really interesting that everything lined up. Unless the coaches just, you know, read the preview magazines themselves and said, the hell with it, put them 11. Wow. Maybe they did, But it all lined up from the power rating standpoint to the coaches poll standpoint. It was all kind of there. So if you saw that article that I put up there yesterday, JC, I did this intentionally. I put South Carolina's schedule up, and then I went through everything with the grades and the ratings and the rank into the rankings and all that type stuff. And then I listed it again and put all of those numbers next to all those teams that are on the schedule. Looks a little bit different when you do that. So I'm just curious. I asked Phil earlier, and I want to ask you the same question. Why do you think some people believe that South Carolina's 2026 football schedule is not as difficult as previous years, or is more manageable?
I don't think it's previous years, and I actually wrote a little about the schedule today in my countdown piece because. The critical four games, you know, it's a 4-4-4-3, and so I identified the critical four game stretch. But I wrote a little about the fact that it's just not chances of it being like last year, and you've all heard me say this a dozen times. I don't hammer the point home because I think even with that schedule, that's no less than a 7-5 football team if they had a decent plan on offense. Even if Dowell Loggins had come back as the OC, I think that's a 7-5 football team at least. But everybody cycled up, and you compare it to A&M where everybody cycled down. And there's always surprises, like the top 25 you just mentioned. There'll be eight teams that we look back, and if we cared to look back in December and laugh at, we would. South Carolina was one of those last year. You know, there's just a lot of uncertainty with the portal and scheduling and all that. I think that when you look at it on paper, though, when you get three teams you know are probably not going to be amongst the best rosters, no matter how surprising some players are, and that's Mississippi State, Kentucky, and Arkansas, you know, and then you have two cupcakes at the beginning, you feel a little bit better than last year. Where, I mean, think about it. Shane Beamer mentioned this, and I don't know if that was the best Texas A&M team in the history of the Aggies, but it was the best in quite some time, at least since the R.C. Slocum era when they were winning the Southwest Conference back in the day. I believe that was the best Vanderbilt team ever. I believe that was the best Ole Miss team ever. Even in the Archie Manning era, Ole Miss wasn't out there in the hunt for – I mean, they were a play away from playing for the national championship. That program's never done anything like that, okay? You also got Oklahoma, who went from a six-win team that couldn't move the football to a playoff team. You've got Alabama, who returned to the playoff on the schedule. And then LSU and Missouri certainly were a little disappointing, especially compared to the hype coming out of Missouri at the beginning of the year. But when did Carolina play them? Well, they played Missouri. It's like the sixth sense. They don't know they're dead. It's like that kid's Haley Joel Osment. They don't know they suck.
Yeah.
That's when Carolina played Missouri, and that's also when they played LSU, both on the road. LSU is still fighting. The meltdown for LSU came against A&M in the second half. That was it. But by the Carolina game, LSU had still been winning. They had beaten Florida. I mean, you know, they were still in the hunt for the playoff. And you know, the only puzzling loss to me was Clemson, because they definitely were down. And that was, to me, the worst loss of the season. But the chances of you getting that again with so much new, like you've got Florida's got a new coach, Tennessee's got a new quarterback that's never – there's seven new quarterbacks. There's six new defensive coordinators. There's five new offensive coordinators. There's four new head coaches. New doesn't always work. New gives you excitement, but it doesn't always work if you're talking about, you know, being consistent and playing a veteran team like Carolina will be. So – I think that's why it feels good. The other part of it, Jamie, is this. There's not – you know, last year Carolina didn't have – everybody talks about November around here. Carolina didn't have a conference home game in November.
Yeah.
It was just the two at the end. I mean, they had to hit the road to Ole Miss and then open date and then A&M. The schedule's kind of back and forth, road away. I mean, home away. And so I think for those reasons on paper it looks that way. I have cautioned everybody, though, that you never know. I mean, with the way they do it, you know, you're in the SEC, man. Your ability to make the playoff largely depends a lot of times on who those six teams that rotate on are. Because you got three permanent now, it's going to be that way. Because, you know, one year, all six of them may be up, may be down. I mean, you know, and if because that's the way they're going to do it. I mean, I don't know that there's an easy way to do it. Then you're going to kind of be at the mercy of that in some years as far as your final outcome.
I for what it's worth, I do think that you're right. I mentioned to Phil earlier, looking at Steele's power ratings, Carolina plays five of the top seven teams in the league. And they play nine conference games. So... I'm not sitting here trying to figure out a way to convince people that South Carolina is playing an exceptionally difficult schedule or something like that. Maybe I think about it. Maybe I've been so conditioned over the years to see things from a coach's point of view that it's hard for me to see it differently. I don't know. But it almost feels like there is like this idea that the Gamecocks need to have Texas or Ole Miss on their schedule as opposed to Kentucky or Arkansas or Mississippi State in order for this to be considered a very difficult league schedule. And you know what I'm saying? Like, well, they don't play LSU, they don't play Ole Miss, and they don't play Texas, right? But they did get Georgia. They do have Tennessee back, and everybody seems to be high on Tennessee once again. And they have to go back to Tuscaloosa, and I don't really care what we think we know about Alabama. You have to go to Tuscaloosa. They're not going to be that bad, you know, and you got to go play down there at night. I mean, if Alabama isn't as good as we have seen Alabama being in over the years, I'm not so sure that he's a soul on earth who's ever stepped foot Bryant-Denny Stadium that's going to say, well, that's a game you should win. No. Because that's not true, you know. So I just don't. I think that the challenges on this schedule are as difficult as they always are. You go to Oklahoma, you go to Alabama, the two winningest programs in the history of the sport. I think something like that. Two of the three, two of the four. I don't know. And you've got a November blue collar game out at Arkansas. We have no idea who they're going to be. We don't have the first clue who they're going to be. And Georgia comes to town. You've got a rebuilding Mississippi State team, and you've got a Florida team that everybody continues to say they've got plenty of talent, and you got to go there. So I'm not disagreeing with you. I'm just making my case. I agree with everything that you've said. I think I look at this schedule and go, they've got the known challenges, and then they've got the unknown challenges. And forgive me if I'm going to give the benefit of the doubt to a team in the SEC being better than people think they are, because we see it every single year on the South Carolina football schedule.
Yeah, another thing is the venues, though. I mean, it's not look, Bryant-Denny, I'd be a moron to sit here and say it's not a tough place to play. No, I mean, it is. Their record speaks for itself.
Yeah.
They have lost some night games to Oklahoma and Texas the last couple of years, but it's very rare. And the 2000 Gamecocks were much better than the 3-8 Bama team that got Mike DeBose fired. But guess what? Bama beat them in Tuscaloosa that day. I was there. It was a day game. But, you know, you go to Bama and Oklahoma, that ain't like going to Texas A&M or LSU. You know, it's just not. It's not like going to Sanford Stadium or Neyland Stadium these days either. Arkansas is not like that. Clemson and Florida are the, if you just talk about venue, like loudest places, those are the two loudest places Carolina plays. So they avoid, like, you know, it's exceptionally difficult to win in Baton Rouge. It is exceptionally difficult to win if you're Carolina at Kyle Field. When Auburn's rolling, it's very hard to win at night down there. Because they're just a cut above venue. Carolina's in that category. So I think that makes it a little bit more manageable because, man, if you look at Carolina's history at Neyland Stadium, it's like, God, don't go. That's good they're coming to Williams-Brice because their history at Williams-Brice isn't much better the last eight games. To the Swamp stinks, but guess what? It's a noon game. And I've watched a lot of Florida football through the years. And then when they kick off early, I mean, they're yawning at Mr. Two Bits.
Yeah.
Or the guest Mr. Two Bits now. May he rest in peace.
They're still cutting their jeans.
Getting out of the trailer, peeing on a manatee first thing in the morning. Yay. Hey. Hey, did you get the babysitter for Dakota? Because the game's about to start. Go Gators. Where's Rowdy?
Yeah.
They named their kids Dakota and Rowdy. Marianne and Pete and Thomas.
Jason.
Not Tom, just Thomas. And they got some German last name like Sherholtz. That's what you find in Florida. These weird last names, common first names. Kids' names are way off, way out of there. I'm talking about the swampy parts, you know, the gates. Anyway.
Yeah, no, we know what you're talking about.
God bless Florida.
Well, I was just curious. You know, at least we got rankings.
It's a fascinating discussion, JB. I really do. Because I think I wrote about it today in my countdown piece. It's And I actually put some of the pundits out there have said, oh, it's a favorable schedule. Some say it's the most difficult. Somebody wrote one of the, I don't remember which, the most difficult schedule in college football. One of the most difficult in college football.
Oh, did they really? Who was that?
I think it may have been Bill Connelly, but
okay.
Matt Anderson eviscerated him in an article in the Big Spot
about some things
he said. But I think it sets up easier than last year. You know?
Well, I think if there's, because I didn't see that, I think where it is, I'll have to go look and see where we have Phil Steele on Friday, so I have to make sure that I know exactly where he's got them from a schedule standpoint. I think it's like 25th or something. But when you have that many differing opinions, like Carolina's strength of schedule is never going to be low, ever. That will never happen when you're in the SEC. Every team in the SEC is always going to have a difficult schedule. So you're never going to have something that is ranked low. But it may be more manageable compared to years past. But when you have that many differing opinions, I think that tells me everything that I need to know about the league that I already knew about the league. There are too many unknowns to be able to predict it.
I think it's all the college football, really. I mean, you know, maybe the Big Ten. Because it's just, yes, you're right.
You see what I'm saying?
The transfer portal's done that, too, because you can't. Can't just go back to three recruiting classes ago who signed a couple good classes, and 70% are still there. Oh, well, they'll have a good – and it's roster. You don't know about the rosters. It's tough. Like Mississippi State, who knows who the hell they signed?
Let me tell you this. Let me lay out a scenario for you. Just both of you, just envision this for a second. Again, I think most people have had a level head about this, but we have been active – in describing the Mississippi State game as a challenge for South Carolina around here for quite some time for a multitude of reasons. I'm not going to take up the entire final half hour of your program explaining why, but we have said that. We've heard our buddy, our good friend, Mike Morgan, say, well, if you don't beat Mississippi State, it's going to be a long year. I'm not saying I disagree with that either. All these statements can be true at the same time. Mm-hmm. But just for a second, put yourself in this frame of mind, okay? It is Monday, and we're popping on the program at 10 in the morning, September the 14th, 2 days removed from September the 12th. South Carolina's 2-0 after blowing out both Kent State and Towson. And we're all going, man, we really like what we see, but they have played nobody. Mississippi State's coming to town 2-0 because they just went to Minnesota, and they hung 38 points on the Gophers and gave up 16, and they look pretty good. The narrative going into that week, this Mississippi State team might be a little bit better than we were thinking around here. Quickly it changes.
I think it's the best thing that could happen for Carolina, in all honesty, is Mississippi State to tattoo Minnesota.
Yeah, because they're not used to winning.
Beat them good. And it's going to get Carolina. The disadvantage of playing those two games like that is, and we've seen this with Tennessee, and even like Missouri, some of Heupel's teams, you know, they'll score 80. Oh, 80. And then, you know, like they get in the game and you know, against the SEC opponent, and it's like 17. Because it's kind of a shock. It's a little bit of a shock. Now, I don't know that Mississippi State's going to be that good on defense. So maybe it's not. But
Do you think they're good on offense? Do y'all think they're good on offense?
I think they got a good running back, and they got a quarterback with a lot of potential, and they've got some pieces at receiver I like some guys from Missouri. Their offensive line,
we don't know yet,
is a question mark.
Don't they have three SEC starters that transferred in that are going to be on the offensive line?
Does A&M, but how many? Mississippi State also got transfers from LSU.
Yeah, I know. Well, I mean, I'm not trying to make a case for them. I was just asking because
I don't know about who are there.
I mean, how about this? How many offensive lines in the SEC aren't rebuilt? Because Carolina's is, Alabama's is, LSU's is, Mississippi State's is, Texas A&M's is, Missouri's is, Florida's is.
Yeah, we're gonna find out. Who's good at this.
Is Georgia the most stable offensive line returning in the league? What about Texas?
Yeah, Texas's guys, I think, are a year older. Georgia, yes, but they lost their top tackle, obviously, Monroe Freeling.
But the majority of their guys returned, though.
Georgia's? Yes.
Yeah, I believe so. How many Kentucky's is rebuilt?
Yeah, Kentucky got a couple of dudes. I mean, they got the kid from Tennessee and some other guys.
So. Yeah, so how many offensive lines in the SEC is it like the old days where you could reasonably predict a team because you knew that they were good in the trenches because you've seen it. You'd already seen it. It's very few.
And that's crazy because, okay, so no, all right, so that's so that's A&M with the SEC transfers, JB.
Mm-hmm.
DJ Chester came from LSU.
Because Ball's over there. Trevon Ball's over there.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's A&M. Mississippi State's got a kid. Blake Steen is from Virginia, and he's projected to start there. L.D. Prudhomme came from Arkansas.
Mm-hmm.
The center is a guy from Dickinson College.
Yeah. Which I don't write those guys off like I used to, for what it's worth.
Heck no, you don't. And then DJ Chester, who we're all familiar with, was at LSU.
At LSU. Carolina tried to get him.
Tried to get him, yeah. And then their right tackle's Jakeem Shumpert Perkins, who's a Mississippi kid from Northwest Mississippi Junior College. They're concerned about that, and they weren't very good last year. But like you said, man, that's a great point. I'm gonna get a research team at thebigspur.com on that. How many around the league are in the same, not maybe to the extreme Carolina is, but are having had to completely rebuild their offensive line through the portal? Because 2 years ago, the rule of thumb was you shouldn't do that. And the only team that was successful doing it was SMU 1 year. And I guess maybe people called up, what's his name? And figured out how to do it, and now it seems like everybody's doing that on the offensive line, and it's probably because nobody's very all that good on the offensive line.
No, I mean I'm, okay. So Tennessee returns 13.
Tennessee, yeah.
They return Sam Pendleton at center. Jesse Perry started 12 games last year at right guard. Okay. Wendell Moe, he's back at left guard. Right tackle looks like Ori Williams is in line to start there. Good God. Ori, where do some of these people come from? He was at LSU, 6'8", 330 pounds. And then of course, David Sanders. So Tennessee's offensive line returns basically.
Yeah. They're fired up about that.
Do what?
Tennessee's fired up about that.
Yeah. Okay. So there's just very few. I'm just sitting here looking through from Phil Steele's.
Yeah, and then even with that, you never know. Cause Florida had all their guys back last year. Right. Remember hearing how Florida was going to be the best offensive line in America.
Yeah.
And then you watch South Florida's defensive front demolish them.
Yeah.
Yeah. They play pretty well against Texas, but sometimes you can just punch Texas in the mouth and they're not going to. That Texas is weird.
So
Oklahoma feels good about theirs, JB, because they played a lot of freshmen last year and they got all those guys back. A lot of those guys back.
It's a great point. You know, so Georgia, Tennessee, and Oklahoma are all on South Carolina's schedule, right?
Unfortunately.
Uh-huh. Yeah. All right, so, you know, again, it kind of goes back to what we were talking about here just a little bit ago. Like, yeah, okay, I got it. You don't play LSU and you don't play Ole Miss and you don't play, you know, Texas. I mean, that's fine. But I don't know that there's enough evidence out there that tells me that Tennessee might not be a top 10 team.
Go ahead.
Yeah, you know, see what I'm saying? Like Mississippi State, the question, like when we're watching them play Minnesota – if we're trying to I asked you about their offense. I agree with y'all. Phil, I agree with you wholeheartedly. JC, I agree with you wholeheartedly. I think offensively Mississippi State's going to be okay. I think that they can probably beat some teams, you know, and as long as Kamario Taylor's healthy and whatever the case is, I think they'll be fine. You know, you're going to have to find a way to stop them. That's for sure. Like, you're going to have to find a way to stop them. Carolina probably can stop them or at least slow them down to be able to win the football game. But when we're watching them play Minnesota, Are y'all going to be more focused on the offense, something that we feel like we know enough about? Or are you going to really be watching the defense? Because if Zach Arnett and Mississippi State all of a sudden defensively show a pulse, they're going to be a problem for somebody, and you just don't want that problem to start in week three in Columbia.
Well, you just got to you gotta look at both quarterback rooms in that Minnesota game. You got Mike Shula on one side helping row the boat, coaching quarterbacks, and you got, if Kamario Taylor does go down, Jaden Rashada.
Yeah.
This is not, don't forget them, JB. Anyway, no, I you know, Minnesota, if anything, is going to have a big, nasty offensive line with guys that have last names like Knudsen, you know, that start with a G, G-N-U-D. And you know, these guys, Minnesota's going to have a baller offensive line, brawler offensive line. And so I'm watching that defense. I'm watching that defense to see if they push them around, because that's exactly what Minnesota's going to try to do, is push them around. And then offensively, how much speed do they have, you know, and how well do they protect? And how does Kamario Taylor throw? He's about a 50-something percent passer last year. But I tell you, when I watched him against Ole Miss, he was impressive. They lost the game. It probably wasn't all that close, but it was pretty impressive. So that's very, very interesting, that whole schedule talk right there. But I'm going to be like, when you mentioned the good offensive lines, I'm going to be like a guy named Paul from Prosperity calling sports talk back in the day and be like, hey, Phil, hey, Stan, going to be able to block Dylan Stewart.
Nope.
Go Cox, bye.
Yeah, well.
You know, hey, it's Paul from Prosperity.
Paul from Prosperity.
I know. We got to get when we have Beamer on, which might be next week. I should hear from debates on that today or tomorrow. Got to get him primed up because we're right around the corner from Carolina Calls. I think that starts on August 27th, I believe, is what I wrote. So hopefully this year somebody will that'll be the happening there. Hey Shane,
hey Shane,
she ain't gonna sing about block Dylan Stewart.
You think Kendall Browse is going to call for a pass tight end?
I got a question for you. Matter of fact, I got two of them. First, appreciate you waving at my mama that one time. And the second is, how is Dylan Stewart healthy? And which tight end do you think has the best chance to catch the first pass of the year? I'll hang up and listen. And go Cox.
It always starts with they turn their radio down.
This is, oh, yeah. Wah, wah, wah,
wah. It sounds like turn your radio down.
David Bowie concert.
Every time. Yeah. Every time. No, but yeah, I've asked Shane that before. I'm like, why don't y'all just answer the phones and say, hey, Michael, welcome to the show. Go ahead and turn your radio down and let us know when you do, and we'll put you on the air.
I've heard,
you know?
Todd do that before. He has, I think one year it got egregiously bad, and he just headed them off. But no, I think the reason I said that, though, is the idea with these good offensive lines in the SEC is that none of them are really that good. And you want your, so the idea is, if you're Carolina, is for your defensive line to not really worry about it.
Yeah.
No, oh, good offensive line. It's just not a chance because they're a really good D line. And I've seen that happen. I mean, it happened in the Georgia game in 19. Remember that day? Georgia had how many NFL players on that offensive line?
100.
I mean, dude, they were all 6'6", 350. And Javon Kinlaw and DJ, I mean, all those guys just destroyed them.
Wore them down.
I mean, and I've seen too many good offensive lines in this league struggle just because of the athleticism and players and depth
Yeah.
that defensive lines have.
When was that, 2 years ago? Shane? Georgia's got like 100 freaking guys that are going to get drafted. You know? 100 freaking five
that
stars.
Was first year, and his first year, man, there was a definite talent. I thought Carolina actually played pretty good that night. I was like, they covered the spread. I had no delusions of grandeur they were going to win that one. But they did cover because it was a 28.5-point spread, and they lost by 27.
Yeah. Yeah. Carolina is 9-1 in their last 10 games on the road against the spread versus top 10 teams. 9-1 against the spread in their last 10 games on the road versus top 10 teams. All right, well, this, that, and the other. I'm going to ease on out of here. Thanks to Monty Lee and David Cloninger and Chris Clark and Rob Williams all for joining us today on the morning show. And God bless the Toman family. We will be thinking about you and praying for you. And thanks to Jim Toman for all those wonderful years. What a man.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, man.
All right, JB.
Thanks, JB.
See y'all tomorrow.
Yeah, man. I have no need to hit a break. What are we going to do now? Right? I don't know. It's wide open Wednesday.
I know.
I don't feel like we should take a break.
I'm making an executive decision here.
All right, let's do it.
So tomorrow we'll have wide open Thursdays.
I like it.
There's no way in 14 minutes I'll be able to get through this. Sorry, folks.
That's all right. Yeah.
All right. So break tunes. I think that's how you say it. JC, I mentioned this earlier, and basing this off a recent coaches poll, but how can Carolina be a consistent winner and get out of the hype, then failure seasons, and then no hype overachieving seasons? And I looked at your comment and during the break, or while I was listening to whatever, or I kind of thought, started thinking about it. It's really been that way since 2014, because 2010 SEC East, and then three straight 11-2s, as gut wrenching as they're so close to going to like four straight SEC championship games under Spurrier, but still really good years. Beating Clemson, beating Clemson that fifth time. I think Clemson actually in 13 had the team to beat Carolina and Columbia, and they just didn't. They turned it over five times. But anyway, in 14. You remember that was the summer of Spurrier. You know, the Carolina had a really good offense coming back. Everybody just assumed the defense would be good. It wasn't. And they had the first game ever on the SEC network. Texas A&M's coming in. They'd never played A&M. Johnny Football's not walking through that door, right? And Carolina was about 11-point favorite, 9-point favorite. Ninth in the country, and A&M beat them like just killed them. And that team finished 7-6. That was a down team. That team still beat Florida and Georgia that year. That team still was 3 fourth quarter stops away from winning the SEC East, believe it or not.
Yeah.
They had three meltdowns. They beat Miami in the bowl game. So you got some scalps that year. Then 15 happened. And so why did 14 happen? Okay, so let's go through that. It's because they had Spurrier, when some good defensive assistants left, I don't think he replaced them. They didn't replace them with good, like equal or better coaches, and certainly not recruiters or evaluators. And some of these guys that came in, and I'm sure they're good people. I mean, I knew some other good people. I mean, this is not personal. But I think they kind of latched on when things were rolling. You know, a lot of them got there in like 2012. So they enjoyed being on that winning staff. And Spurrier, unlike, you know, like Beamer and Muschamp, it's all about recruiting and building the roster. And they're constantly thinking about it. That wasn't necessarily Spurrier's thing. He had guys helping him to do that. There was no leadership there. And so the players were bad. I mean, they didn't really have a quarterback, you know, except until Perry Orth stabilized it. And even then, that 15 team, once Elliott took over, was very competitive. So then 16, let's just say that team, that period of time, and no offense to the 2020 team, that 16 team before Jake Bentley took over and Rico Dowdle got healthy and all that, Phil, that was one of the worst team Carolina. I mean, they just didn't have anybody. I mean, I'll put it this way. Muschamp inherited the roster. There were 26 guys that transferred out. I think two of them ever played college football again. That's during an 85-man scholarship limit. So my point is the decline from 2014 to 15 was due to roster mismanagement and staff mismanagement. And most of the time, roads lead to that. And some of it, I can sit here and say in hindsight, And it's kind of hypocritical of me to say it was bad, but I think the people making the hires, including Steve Spurrier, has mentioned it several times. I should have fired some of those guys. Yeah.
You're right.
Yeah, especially on defense. So it cycled back up, and Muschamp doubled the win total, goes to Birmingham Bowl. Very promising because you had a lot of freshmen. 17 was kind of a function of schedule after Debo got hurt in game 3 against Kentucky, which was a bad day. But they still won. They found a way to win. They found a way to beat Vandy and Tennessee and Florida. We're not as competitive against Clemson. Hey, they beat Wofford by 21. Muschamp had a big old win over triple option Wofford. I mean, that was a big win that year. And then they beat Michigan in the bowl, so things are looking up because they're recruiting. 18 massive amounts of injuries on defense, also kind of over. You know, and this is what scares me about the secondary this year, because everybody's like, I trust Torian Gray. And I do. And right. That's true. But everybody has bad years, right? You know, in coaching. And I think that year in 18, it's like Muschamp's a defensive genius. The defense is going to be good. And the offense is going to ball out. Well, the offense did ball out a lot. But the defense, by the time, I mean, that Clemson game, they gave up 744 yards. They had 600, but they get, you know, I saw guys that I'd never seen in a Gamecock uniform out there play defensive end against the national champions.
Yeah, right.
That's how bad it was. 19, quarterback gets hurt. And yep. This has happened a lot in the history of this program, too. A key player goes out.
Mm-hmm.
And it, usually a quarterback wrecks the season. 2020, COVID. And quarterback issues, and mostly COVID, though. That was like, I always say that, you know, Will Muschamp had some bad luck in his coaching career. Like, there are some games that were very Muschampian. That's what I call them. I mean, Carolina opened with Coastal Carolina, who was really good, who would have scared them probably. East Carolina and Vanderbilt. Three straight home games were supposed to open the 2020 season.
Mm-hmm.
You know, full allotment of players, no opt-outs, all that. Well, as it stood, nah, you open with Tennessee and Florida, and then you play all a whole SEC schedule. And then Marshawn Lloyd blew out his knee. Marshawn Lloyd was going to start as a true freshman over Kevin Harris. Right? Mm-hmm. I mean, he was going to. So that knew that, and that ended Muschamp. 2021, cycle back up. Nobody expected Carolina to go to a bowl, and that team did not look good. Until they did, kind of like 16, but a little bit more talented. 2022 was a cycle up at the end with those big wins. So everybody's excited, right? 23, boom. I can tell you 23 probably had more to, I mean, it was all roads led to the offensive line injury issue. I don't even know that was coaching that year. Obviously, as we've moved forward, we found out that because some of these guys took their lumps that year and they never got any better, now they're at different schools.
Yeah.
Maybe there was some things going on. But that year, I mean, you can't go to battle with the guys you're going to battle with. And I thought it was kind of, I guess, a good job to rally the troops and come within a win of a bowl game. And they should have beaten Florida that year, really. So 24 comes along, bad start, Lenore Sellers, all that's a cycle back up, right? Talk of college football again for a month. And then last year, you know, I think the combo of the schedule, the combo of losing some leadership, which helps you when times get rough. Beamer's not lying when he says that. Right. And then the overriding factor of what the heck are we doing on offense again, that tanked that season. So there are tangible reasons for this roller coaster. Some of it's just chance with injuries. Some of it's mismanagement, coaching hire mismanagement by personnel. But you want to know how they're going to be consistent. I think that word personnel, you've got to keep good personnel in place, which Carolina's done a good job of. And if there's not somebody that's good, you got to get rid of them. And then if you replace them, you have to replace them with somebody that's just as good or better. I've seen too many programs lose coordinators when things are successful. And this is why I've got my eye on A&M this year, Phil. and just promote from within or do this, do that, the other. And look, sometimes the internal promotion works. Look at Clemson. Tony Elliott was promoted from within.
Right.
He was ready to roll. You know, they had a squad. Arguably, some of the things he did were better than Chad Morris. You know? But, and it's hard to do that. It's hard to say exactly how things work out. But, you know, it's personnel related, coaching related, all that. So, and that's been all three head coaches have made mistakes that have been costly as far as that goes. I'm not saying South Carolina wins every single game if those mistakes aren't made. I'm just saying they'll probably are better years. So
true. Yeah.
Quantrell says, on three partnering with the prediction market. I don't know how to feel about that. Yeah, I don't know much about that. It is Polymarket. They are our official predictions partner at On3. Maybe Quantrell, we can, when we got wide open Thursday tomorrow, you could put in the chat box kind of what, I've never gotten into that. I don't know what that is exactly.
Yeah, I'm kind of similar to you. Was like, I understand it kind of, but I don't understand it enough to be able to comment on it intelligently. So I won't.
Yeah, I just know that, you know, they're our official partners or whatever. Lauren says something about the defense not being good. I'm going to say this about the defense, Lauren. They could very well give up more points than you're used to if this is a tempo offense that's run kind of how I think it's going to be run. And what you got to do if you're bothered by it, you're like, our defense sucks now. Don't say that. Look at Saban's defenses at Alabama and the NFL players that they had on those they were elite defenses.
Yeah.
And when they started going fast and chunking all over, they gave up points, more points than he's ever given up. Because you get a track meet like that, when you're back and forth, the defense doesn't have time to rest, that kind of thing. And that does affect things. That's why defensive-minded coaches don't like tempo offenses. They don't like it. Because they can't, it's hard for them to stop. And then they don't like their head coach to run it because their defense gets worn slam out.
Yeah.
And it's like, but Clayton White, though, from what I hear through the grapevine, Clayton kind of likes this.
He digs it.
He's not an old school defensive coach. And my theory on that is if your offense is very good and scoring quickly and you're putting points on the board, as a defensive coach, you can gamble a little more. So, like that daggum, that was one of the gutsiest defensive calls I've ever seen.
I love that.
And it
worked
against Alabama. Yeah.
Against double corner blitz.
Ty Simpson and those receivers. You know what I think we'll do? We're going to dial up a double corner blitz.
Yeah, that's right.
Yo, and it worked.
And it worked.
I think it was Vakari Swain took his head off and made him fumble. But that was smart coaching, I think, because if you look at Ty Simpson, he's very good at avoiding pressure from his backside, moving, you know, or moving over. So you got two guys coming, and so you know, he got it. And he didn't. I saw Ty Simpson against Vanderbilt a couple of times. I watched almost all that game. Fumble and recover his own fumble a couple of times. So he did have an issue with holding on to the ball. So, Krager said the Austin, Brooks Austin video. I think it's Brooks Austin. It's not Austin. Brooks Austin. Breakdown video was awesome. Yeah, it was. And it was eye-opening for me, I think. I mean, just me personally. Look, I freely admit, in the sport of football, there are people that could do things I cannot do. I have to listen to them. Krager said, how many of Sellers' misses were because of footwork? The misses that he didn't have a lot of pressure on him? 100% probably. And that was what he needed to work on going in. We talked about that last year.
Right.
Get the footwork right. And what you do, I think, instead of square peg round holing it, is if you have a college quarterback that's, you know, needs to get his footwork right and all that good stuff, that's fine. Well, and then if he just cannot do it, then you just don't have him plant his feet. It's, you know, so Hey, Cav says Clayton White knows how to handle up-tempo offenses. That's why I'm so high on our ceiling this year. Yeah, do the math. I get that has to be reality. Yeah, I mean, and at Western Kentucky, Tyson, I think Tyson Hilton was a coach. They run an air raid, so.
Mm-hmm.
Spot the ball is what Clayton White has to say. Now, Gregor, I was actually thinking today, is it Brooks Austin or Austin Brooks? But it's Brooks Austin.
Yeah, the only reason I know is because I actually wrote it down yesterday on my little legal.
We got to get him on the show.
Yeah, so we can get him on. Yeah.
That guy's good.
Mm-hmm.
He's really good. So anyway, gosh, it's time to go already.
I know. That's all right. We'll make it up tomorrow. We'll make
an abbreviated version of the show.
That's right.
We had a lot going on today. Packed house, guest-wise. Unfortunate passing of Jim Thoman. Thanks to Monty Lee for joining us. Yeah. Montrell says defense gives him zero concern. Hey, Cavalier says, I blame the entire season on Shula last year. And I feel so bad. I almost feel like, go ahead.
No. What I was going to say is, and it goes back to the, talking about defense and up-tempo, is that there were times where that defense was on the field as much last year as they would have been in a up-tempo offense, but there were no points there to help them out. So some of these guys have that kind of experience just in a more depressing setting, in that nobody was scoring that many points on the offensive side last year. And it'll feel a lot better coming in quickly off of a touchdown than it will be off a turnover.
Yeah, and the other thing about it too is when your offense isn't scoring, what you'll do sometimes is like pick your poison.
Yeah,
You won't gamble, you won't blitz because you're trying. It's not like prevent, but you're trying. You're like, okay, well if they get a field goal, so that's like we could live with that, but they cannot score a touchdown. So you're kind of making them. I don't know. Shula. I almost feel bad for him because I mean he was perfectly happy and doing a good job just being a quarterback's coach.
Yeah.
That's what he's doing in Minnesota this year. He's actually pretty good at it. Because Lenoris did get better. Dowell Loggins just kind of called plays on Shula wasn't coaching him up. But I think it's just a different world when you start getting into calling plays and running the offense. And then, if you're multitasking, are you really coaching him up? Or I felt bad for him. He was in a bad situation.
Yeah.
There's some people that have been bad coaches here that I think are bad people. Or people that I don't care for. People that, you don't really mind seeing them get fired because they were kind of jerks or whatever. Not to me personally, but just jerks.
Yeah.
And then there's people that, gosh, you just feel bad, And there's people that get fired that you really like and admire, you just feel bad for them. They're pretty good coaches that probably shouldn't have been.
It just didn't work out for whatever reason.
Caught up in a change or whatever. Yep. So it is what it is, folks. So anyway, we'll be back tomorrow. Don't forget, we're running a huge special. Huge.
Huge.
On thebigspur.com, Gamecock Central, for two, four. You can sign up for a year. If you're a new member, right? 1 year, $2.49 a month. It's a bam, $29.99 charge right now. We will be talking about the Cutter Woods or Landon Duckworth era, God willing, and the creek don't rise by the time you have to pay again.
That's right. That's right.
So let's rock and roll, man. Get on over there. It's not going to last long. We'd go out of business if we did this every day. But it is a tremendous deal. I mean, newspapers, gosh,
You can't get an annual subscription to a newspaper that doesn't get delivered to your door for this, Jason.
Look, some of them are this much a month.
Right.
The Wall Street Journals were 40. And you get all of On Three Rivals, all that good stuff. So please check that out on thebigspur.com, GameCockCentral.com. And we'll be back Thursday for the Mad Dogs, JC. I'll let you soon.